Hello, this is Thomas Garza, and I would like to thank you for joining me today for the reading of the Christian Science Monitor. The Christian Science Monitor is a Pulitzer Prize-winning international daily newspaper, and I'm reading from the online edition dated Sunday, February 21st. We'll begin today's reading with an article entitled CSI Cleveland, How the City is Curbing Sexual Violence. Ohio's second-largest city has become a national leader in responding to rape cases and dealing compassionately with victims. Registered nurse Elizabeth Boothus was haunted by one rape victim. Petite, late 20s, clad in jeans and a sweatshirt, sitting alone crying, nose running with a hollow look on her face as she twirled the long blonde hair coursing down her back, while waiting in the perpetually frenetic emergency room of Metro Health Medical Center on Cleveland's Near West Side. Ms. Booth had just recently been hired. She watched from behind the nurse's station as the young woman returned to be examined again and again. Each time, the charge nurse explained that she would have to wait. More severely injured patients were ahead of her. In Cleveland's only Level 1 trauma center, ER triage basically went like this: life-threatening and everything else. A lesser rape victim had sustained injuries requiring emergency treatment. The person had to be, well, patient. Growing increasingly agitated, the young woman began pacing the hallway, cursing under her breath. Finally, after 5 or 6 hours of stomping and fuming, she screamed, "Give me a break!" and stormed out of the ER. That was in 2008, and it wasn't the last time Booth would become upset by the look of hopelessness in the eyes of a rape victim forced to endure the humiliating experience of feeling as if no one cared. In fact, Booth still shudders at how victims who choose to wait were finally treated. Since none of the hospital staff were trained in how to provide a thorough medical and forensic rape examination, someone would crack open a manual and read the directions for the procedure. There was no other area of medicine where that would be acceptable, she said. It just got to me. So I thought, all right, I'll do the training myself and see where it goes. Just 8 years later, the indefatigable Booth is the hospital's sexual assault nurse examiner coordinator, working specifically with rape victims. She has trained 30 other nurses at Metro to become certified SANEs. The hospital is now a national training center for this growing specialty area of forensic nursing. Booth's pioneering efforts symbolize how Cleveland has become a national leader in new approaches to handling rape and sexual assault. Across the country, a growing number of cities are shifting their perceptions of sexual violence, taking more seriously crimes that many advocates have long thought were overlooked by police, prosecutors, and healthcare professionals. But few have pushed as far as Cleveland. Since 2009, the city has significantly accelerated its efforts to combine more aggressive methods to take sexual offenders off the streets with more compassionate ways to help survivors reclaim their lives. The revamped mindset has already achieved tangible results. A county task force investigating a backlog of more than 4,800 sexual assault cases has tallied a conviction rate of 90%, with 120 defendants sentenced so far. Authorities estimate they will hand down more than 1,000 indictments as they complete the project over the next few years. Moreover, agencies responsible for law enforcement, prosecution, health care, and social wellness have begun to work together instead of operating independently, and sometimes in conflict with each other, as they pursue cases and deal with victims. Through the county's sexual assault response team, for example, they meet regularly, train together, and collaborate closely to ease the far-reaching effects of those once-neglected offenses. At MetroHealth, Booth no longer recoils at the treatment of victims, either. When a sexual assault victim arrives, the hospital's ER nurses or social workers immediately contact the Cleveland Rape Crisis Center, the CRCC, to send an advocate for the victim. person assists and comforts the victim until the person can be treated in a private, separate area of the emergency department. Typical wait time, 30 minutes. No one waits longer than an hour. No one. Cleveland has been a really strong forerunner in these efforts, has accomplished some great things and taken some important steps forward, says Monica Johnson Hostler, president of the National Alliance to End Sexual Violence, based in Washington, D.C. Cleveland's approach to sexual violence all changed on Halloween of 2009. That was the night local police arrested Anthony Sowell for what would become the most brutal serial rape and murder spree in the city's modern history. In the days following his arrest, crime scene investigators unearthed the bodies of 11 women the Cleveland Strangler had wrapped in plastic garbage bags and buried in his backyard or left in places within his house. On the strength of an embarrassment of evidence, Mr. Sowell was convicted and sentenced to death on August 12, 2011. His home on Cleveland's East Side, which had become known as the House of Horrors, was razed on December 6, 2011. Deeply disturbed by the crimes, the major institutions that combat sexual violence began to implement fundamental changes. 2 months after Sowell's arrest, Cleveland Mayor Frank Jackson formed the Special Commission on Missing Persons and Sex Crimes Investigation. Issued on March 30, 2010, its report proposed 26 recommendations for handling these issues differently, including adding a countrywide missing persons bureau. Later that year, one of the most visible demonstrations of the new approach occurred when the Cleveland Police Department refurbished the offices of its sex crimes and special victims units, which had been combined into one department. The offices were painted with softer, warmer colors, and private rooms were added so that police would no longer have to interview victims in an open bullpen. Captain James McPike sits in a private office with a glass wall overlooking the cubicles. He remembers the old offices because he had a desk in the bullpen for 6 years before being transferred in 2008 to the 4th District, where Sowell was later captured. In 2012, the Cleveland Police Department named McPike head of the Special Victims Section, which includes both the sex crimes, child abuse, and domestic violence units. Shortly after he took over, McPike initiated a program to have his detectives work directly with Rape Crisis Center advocates assigned to victims from day one of a case. They advise victims on counseling, healthcare advocacy, and other services available through the center. They also guide them through the police interview and investigation and the justice system processes. Last year, Cleveland began funding one advocate to work with the Special Victims Unit full-time. Our partnership with the Cleveland Police Department has never been as strong as it is now, says Sandra Miller, CRCC's president and chief executive officer. The Sowell case moved us in that direction. Ms. Hostler of the National Alliance to End Sexual Violence considers Cleveland one of the 5 cornerstone rape crisis centers in the United States, along with Boston, Washington, Pittsburgh, and San Francisco. Nationally, we need a lot of work to make all of our rape crisis centers the beacon of hope in their communities that Cleveland has accomplished, she says. McPike remembers how hard it used to be, the crush of caseloads, the emotionally wrenching nature of the crimes. He'd wake up at 3 a.m. worried about the interviews, trials, and other dimensions of cases he was handling. At the time, each detective in the Special Victims Unit was handling at least 30 open sexual assault and felony child abuse cases. Now that he's in charge, McPike says he wants to be sure that victims are treated well and implement his goal of leading one of the best investigative units in the country. There's a greater understanding in our profession that this is a unique crime that often takes place in private, McPike says. So we take more victim-centered approach because they deserve to be treated with empathy and compassion. The Sowell case reinforced 2 lessons. First, sexual predators often attack people who live on the margins of society because they are easier prey and are less likely to report their crimes or be believed if they do report them. Second, there are no strange stories. I tell police officers, Please don't judge what you're hearing, because sometimes the craziest story could be the truth, says McPike. The first responding officer judges the victims. It causes the victims to have doubts, and then they become less likely to cooperate with the detective's investigation. Booth concurs. In her job at Metro, both she and her sane nurses interact with the police almost daily. Forced to meet in the hospital cafe because her office is stacked floor to ceiling with boxes of new clothes and toiletries donated for victims through a recent campaign, Booth says, in the frontline person didn't believe the survivor of a sexual assault, the patient would just take off before we could do our exam. Now that they're being believed and treated well, they stay and complete the entire extensive and exhausting examination. Cooperative patients are more inclined to participate in the prosecution and testify in court, something Booth and her nurses do regularly themselves. Also, the victim's healing process is improved, since they are more willing to seek counseling and discuss the assault with family members and friends who can support them. The police interviews she hears today no longer lead with, "What were you wearing? How much did you drink? Were you doing drugs?" Instead, they focus immediately on the assault. Often, officers will stay until the person's SANE examination is finished so they can take the person home or to a safe location. As part of the changes underway, MetroHealth will soon be getting a new sexual assault examination center. Last year, Booth partook in a Shark Tank-style competition held by the hospital to fund innovative projects. For her presentation, she applied makeup and cried to depict a battered rape victim's experience in the ER and underscore the critical need for a separate SANE unit. Out of 105 submissions, Booth was one of six approved for funding. She was awarded $100,000. She is waiting for her new unit to be built. 10 years ago, approximately 200 such examination programs existed throughout the U.S., and now there are more than 600. More are needed. If you divide that by 50 states, that's a little more than 10 programs to cover an entire state, Booth says. So we are fortunate in Northeast Ohio to have four hospitals with established programs, but a lot of our rural areas still don't have easy access. Imani Capri knows the importance of having institutional support. She had been molested and raped by her stepfather, starting at age 11. She escaped his clutches after college, but wrestled with the experience for several years. Then, in 2005, she decided to act. She decided to pursue prosecution. It may have taken me becoming a 25-year-old woman to fight for justice that 11-year-old, but I did it, Ms. Capri says. He took a lot from me, but I didn't let him take my voice. Capri found a sympathetic reception from the Cuyahoga County Prosecutor's Office. Over the past decade, the office has been taking a more vigorous approach to prosecuting rape and sexual assault. Capri's first trial in April 2006 ended in a hung jury. She was devastated, but the prosecutor, who has since taken another job, told her they would pursue a second trial. She said, "You'd better rest up because I'm not letting this go," Capri recalls. At the second trial in November 2007, her stepfather was found guilty and received a particularly heavy sentence, 20 years before eligibility for parole, with 5 years of probation and registered sex offender status. The prosecutor's office learned from the success of her case. They even invited Capri to speak to a group of more than 100 prosecutors, focusing on the compassionate manner in which her attorneys handled her investigation and trials. Being able to break my silence and pursue justice with their full support helped me heal and realize I could find a route to success again, she says. So compassion is way more powerful than they thought. In July 2011, the summer Sowell was sentenced, the prosecutor's office launched a new initiative to test the backlog of sexual assault kits, or SAKs, the kits a medical examiner uses to collect key forensic evidence, such as DNA, in rape cases. According to McPike, DNA testing, which only became available in the mid-1990s, had been too expensive for the Cleveland Police Department's Sex Crimes Unit, running in the range of $4,000 to $5,000 per kit. By 2012, improved laboratory techniques had dropped costs to $433 per kit. so Ohio Attorney General Mike DeWine made testing a priority. He invested in robotic testing equipment and 10 new people for the laboratory of the Bureau of Criminal Investigations, the state's official crime lab, to test the high volume of kits submitted from across Ohio. The result was a reduction in turnaround time of more than 100 days. Then, in January 2013, Cuyahoga County Prosecutor Timothy McGinty formed the SAK Task Force. The question was not just, are you testing the kits, but are you pursuing the follow-up work needed to prosecute the case? Says Richard Bell, Assistant County Prosecutor and Criminal Investigations Division Chief for Cuyahoga County. Prosecutors also realized BCI had such a high success rate of developing DNA profiles, which could be uploaded into a Federal Bureau of Investigation database shared with law enforcement agencies across the country, that they would need more investigators. Indeed, BCI's 60% hit rate, the rate at which their evidence identified an offender on the FBI's combined DNA index system, was higher than anywhere else in the U.S. Because of the volume of SAKs, about 35 completed kits come from the BCI lab each week, Mr. Bell's division now employs a crew of 25 investigators, 6 assistant prosecutors, 2 supervisors, and 2 paralegals. 4 advocates are assigned to assist survivors throughout the justice process. At 9 a.m., on a Tuesday, SAK Task Force members assemble for their weekly meeting in a 7th-floor conference room in downtown Cleveland. Sizable north-facing windows frame vistas of Lake Erie, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and Museum, the first energy field where the Cleveland Browns play, these days not very well. Roughly 20 of the task force investigators, prosecutors, advocates, and administrators sit around a long conference table or in chairs along the walls. Others sit at a smaller table in an adjoining section that also doubles as Bell's office for the 2.5 days a week he is here. A large desk, credenza, and shelves are mostly empty because his main office is across the street in the county prosecutor's office, but his children have given him several pictures to decorate the space. Seated next to Bell, Mr. McGinty questions the team about several open cases, including one that is currently in court across the street. At the last minute, one of the 3 victims has decided not to testify. McGinty and the team decide they need her testimony to ensure they can put away a man accused of a series of vicious rapes who they believe is a severe threat to public safety. Since this marks the first time in 3 years, they must issue a warrant for a victim. They weigh the pros and cons for quite a while before they need to get this guy off the street wins out. Concerned for the difficult position of the victim, McGinty turns to Brett Kiker, Bell's prosecutorial colleague who runs the daily operations. Make sure they include a statement in the warrant that she will never cross the threshold of a prison, he says. Police will pick her up at her house. She will testify as soon as she arrives in court, and the police will escort her home. Next on the agenda, Bell reviews year-end statistics for the task force that are projected on a screen at the front of the room. The percentage of offender DNA hits on CODIS hovers at 59%, still the highest of any city. They have completed 1,500 rape investigations each of the past 2 years, maintained a 90.5% conviction rate in 2015, and have reached an approximate halfway point with 438 indictments. McGinty tells the team that he's seen an increase in public confidence because of their successes, and that will lead to an increase in reporting of rapes and sexual assaults. He's proud of the collaborative efforts between different agencies. After the meeting breaks up, Bell crosses to his office to convene with Mr. Kiker and Rachel Lovell, co-principal investigator at the Begun Center for Violence Prevention Research and Education at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland. Ms. Lovell, who attends most of the weekly meetings, informs Bell and Kiker about the specific types of offender and victim characteristics they have coded in their research. Last year, the task force partnered with social science researchers at CWRU and gave them $100,000 of federal funding they had received, along with 20 years of case files from the SAK initiative. This March, the one-year study will issue reports on details of the crimes with analysis of patterns and behaviors and what factors contributed to successful prosecutions. Other federal and local grants, totaling $3.5 million, are being used to underwrite the CWRU research into process untested kits. According to Bell, the task force has learned several key lessons. Brutal point number one. They have discovered 298 serial rapists who assaulted 902 victims. The DNA hits prove that these serial offenders are not locked into one type of victim or one method of operation, as was traditionally believed. If you're jerk enough to rape a stranger, you're probably not compassionate or empathetic towards the women in your life, so you're likely to assault an acquaintance, Bell says. Doesn't seem like it should be, but that was an epiphany to prosecutors and police alike. Knowing this, investigators are now more diligent in searching for evidence of multiple rapes, which can strengthen the case against an offender on trial for raping an acquaintance and claiming it was consensual. The DNA trail has connected offenders to other victims, too, from car theft to burglary. As part of their efforts, task force members have also tallied just how costly sexual assault cases can be. So far, they've identified $220 million in outlays for the cases, ranging from hospital and counseling fees of victims to the expense of trials and out-of-pocket costs for victims who attend. Recent statistics indicate that the total costs of a rape typically reach at least $87,000. Tracking those amounts is essential, Bell says, because it shows funders that their financial support contributes to prevent further rapes and other crimes those offenders are likely to commit, which saves money. As they've learned more about sexual crimes and how to deal with them, Cleveland officials are increasingly being asked to speak across the country. We're trying to help other jurisdictions learn from our mistakes, says Bell, who notes that task force members have talked to police departments in at least 20 cities. We see the similarities in other places where kits weren't tested or not enough detectives were put on cases to investigate and find the victims, so cases were regularly shut down when they should have been kept open. Standing nearby with snow swirling in the gray lakefront skies behind her in the window of Bell's office, Lovell reflects on the groundbreaking work being done in Cleveland. There's not a lot of research-based literature on sexual violence, she says, so our ultimate goal is to change the way we talk about rape, treat rape victims, and support them. Our next article is entitled Palestinian Developer Builds City of Dreams. But will they come? Hailed as a building block of a future state, a brand new West Bank city is struggling to persuade Palestinians to move out of their traditional communities. Before Manar Imad and her family moved into a new three-bedroom apartment here, a relative balked. My brother-in-law said, "You're going to a ghost town. It has no shops. It's empty," laughs Miss Imad. It's true that when we moved in, it was empty, but now it's a growing city. Day after day, it's filling up with people and shops. It's a great city, she says. The reality lies somewhere in between. Rawabi, a $1.2 billion mega housing project 5 miles north of Ramallah, is the first ever Palestinian planned city and was originally feted as a building block for a future state. But Israeli red tape delayed approval for roads and access to water, and it took 6 years from breaking ground for the city to welcome the first intake of residents, including Imad and her family. Now comes a moment of truth for the Palestinian city of dreams. How to lure businesses and tens of thousands of middle-class residents to make the move, transforming the hilltop project from a construction site into a breathing city. Rawabi's promise is a modern community with its own cultural institutions, shops, and jobs, but it requires that socially conservative Palestinians leave their traditional West Bank neighborhoods of extended families and move into a new city that mixes people from varying clans and cities of origin. The test comes at a time when the prospects for Palestinian statehood seem to have receded completely, and violence has caused an economic slowdown. In the half year since Rawabi opened to residents, home sales have been slow. Several businesses that were planning to open up have gotten cold feet. The project has even stopped advertising. Today, the stone-paved streets of Rawabi's first neighborhood are lined with small shrubs, street lamps, and even public exercise machines. But after dark, light emanates only from the windows of lone apartments amid a canyon-like row of darkened residential buildings. At a Roman-style amphitheater, the seating has been completed, but construction is incomplete on school buildings, a medical clinic, and the town's commercial center. Bashar Masri, the Palestinian business mogul behind Rawabi, says the initial euphoria for the project was lost during years of construction delays. In the last few months, the economic climate has become even more challenging, he says, because a wave of violence with Israel has made buyers and businesses more risk-averse. People are not as excited. It's difficult for people to be happy when they are surrounded by sadness, he says. Coming to buy a house is a huge endeavor. It's a risk to change your life, and people don't like to do it unless they are totally comfortable. And they aren't comfortable at all. Earlier this month, the Israeli military imposed a one-day closure around Ramallah in response to an attack, highlighting the inconvenient location of a security checkpoint on the road from Ramallah, the hub of economic life in the West Bank, to Rawabi's hilltop location. Rawabi bills itself as a national project. A brochure waxes patriotic about Palestinian flags that fly above the buildings, in stark contrast to a predominant attitude of acquiescence, a sense of powerlessness, and a fear that we have not managed to accomplish anything of significance. The city embodies the state-building philosophy championed by former Palestinian Prime Minister Salam Fayyad, who argued that Palestinians could still build an effective government and economy under Israel's military occupation. The argument is that economic development can be a form of resistance to Israel and boost international support for statehood. Even though peace negotiations are nowhere in sight, Mr. Masri insists a Palestinian state is in the making. It's not whether we will have a state or not, it's when we will have a state. We're not going to wait for the day that the right parameters are in the right place to sign an agreement. We, the people, will continue to build and make our lives better and our economy better. But critics say the project plays into an alleged Israeli strategy to quench Palestinian aspirations with economic development rather than full statehood. Rawabi is part of the Israeli strategy of economic peace, says Tariq Dana, a policy advisor at Al-Shabaka, a Palestinian think tank. Ultimately, Israel remains in control over the territory. Financed with hundreds of millions of dollars from a Qatari government investment fund and Masri's conglomerate, Masar International, builders have so far completed work on 1,300 of 5,000 homes slated for the project. Half the completed units have been sold, though that's roughly the same number as has been reported 2 years ago. So far, according to project officials, 200 families have moved in. Residents and officials predict that the planned opening of a local school in September will spur more arrivals. Come back during the summer and you'll see how prosperous Rawabi is, promises Iman, whose husband works in Ramallah as an engineer for Rawabi. The mother of one says she feels more secure in her new neighborhood than she did in her husband's hometown of Jenin, in the northern West Bank, where she worried about street violence and raids by Israel. Well, this has been the reading of the Christian Science Monitor. Please join us next time for more stories from around the world. And until then, have a great week.